Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
Cybersecurity. We all know we should be looking at it, but it's something we just hope will go away. Well, guess what? It's not. Today we'll be talking to Nicholas Michalakis, and who is from Tweak IT. He has a really broad knowledge from the industry, 20 years IT experience, and he'll run through some practical tips of what to look out for. Welcome to the Community Conversations podcast, Nicholas. I was excited to do this interview today because cybersecurity is on everybody's lips for one way or another, whether it be the scams, whether it be protecting organisations, and of course, very seriously, the governance for organisations, the cybersecurity governance required for not-for-profit directors is quite significant. So we really wanted to make sure that community centres had an easy conversation about what's some tips, what's involved, what should they be doing. And hence, we're talking to you today.
Well, that's a very good question, Kerry. Thank you for having me, by the way. Yeah, with cybersecurity, especially like with businesses and government, they have to take everything very seriously. They can't just sort of ignore it. In my line of work, I have a lot of small businesses that still use sort of generic routers and networking equipment, say provided by their ISPs like Telstra or Optus. And they're just using off-the-shelf sort of home brand sort of antiviruses like Norton, Kaspersky. Even though Kaspersky's been banned from the US because it is a Russian company, a lot of people started pulling away from that. Trend Micro, a lot of the home brand securities they tend to use with their businesses to sort of try and cut costs, where I'm trying to come in and sort of explain that you need high-level security, like adding hardware to your network, which basically blocks malicious attacks from the hardware level, and then also having endpoint security on the PC. So basically having hardware on the network and then software on the PC to give it a double level of security.
Nicholas, for a lot of our community centres, they act like a small business. They have their own network, their own computers, they've got their own management committee, which is why I mentioned the governance. But importantly, they have many people accessing the network. For example, volunteers come in,
yep.
The paid staff, but there's also the community come in and often they'll use computers for digital access. Now, that leaves them quite open, doesn't it?
It does. That's where you have to make sure that your IT crew have basically put in restrictions that block basically guest or public access away from the rest of the system that, you know, you've got important documents and private files that you want to keep secure and everything like that. You want to keep that separate and locked away from the generic public use.
So let's have a look and make this easy because not everyone's a computer expert. In fact, most people aren't, Nicholas. So let's just take this right back to basics.
Yeah.
So what is the process that community centres can use to assess what they have in place?
Well, community centres should start looking into having basically not just an off-the-shelf router or modem or anything like that. They want to have something that's called an endpoint security. So one company I do work with is WatchGuard, and basically, not to go too deep into it, it's basically a piece of equipment you plug into your existing network, and what that does from there is you can set up policies and rules by your IT admin or by Tweak IT, and basically we can set up rules. So if a customer, a client, or a work employee brings in a USB from home, you know, with their work, if that has a potential malware or virus on it, that gets picked up within a millisecond, less than a millisecond, and gets blocked and quarantined straight away on the system. Whereas with off-the-shelf like Norton Security or any home type of antivirus, that can take a while because it actually has to scan the whole system. Within that time, that malware can actually lock and encrypt that system, which then you're then being ransomed by Bitcoin or Amazon gift vouchers.
So that's the hardware and software side. Let's have a look at what people need to be aware of. How do we keep staff, volunteers, or people using any of our systems up to date? Because it's a constantly changing field, isn't it?
Yeah, well, especially now coming up close to October, because Windows 10 expires on the 14th of October, so which means no more security updates for Windows 10. So you have to make sure all PCs are now Windows 11 compliant, upgraded to Windows 11, and also updated to the latest version of Windows 11 as well. I know it's annoying because a lot of people do not like switching operating systems because they're sort of happy with the way they are, but doing that will sort of reinsure some level of security. Also, with standard use, again, you would have to have sort of some network and software rules in place so you can block certain websites, only certain websites are allocated, And also bandwidth allocation as well, because say you've got a 100 megabit connection at the office and you've got someone there watching YouTube or watching Netflix and stuff like that, and you've got multiple people doing that, that will reduce the speed. Then the workers can't upload or do their daily browsing for the company. So basically you can have to have restrictions on that, which would limit time and access to those public usages by other people.
So it's sounding, Nicholas, that the whole comms and computer policies and procedures need to be reviewed in line with cybersecurity.
Yeah, they do. It really depends on the IT department that's in there. If they're very clear and up to date with everything like that, they should be already putting these practices in place. If they're not, that's a huge risk.
So if we look at how to keep people up to date with what's happening and what to be mindful of, should tests be being done, like is it phishing scams that we look out for so people don't click on things?
Yeah, so basically checking is sort of with email phishing scams, sort of if you see something from like Optus or Facebook, always check the email address. It may be they can craft them up so well to make them look legitimate, but you always have to look at the email address. Say, for example, Facebook. If it's from Facebook.com, pretty much legitimate. But if it's followme.facebook.com, if there's an extension to the Facebook address, ignore it, delete it straight away.
Well, that's also now they're doing MyGov scarily and the tax department.
Yes, and that's where a lot of my clients, because I deal with the domestic sector, I get a lot of elderly customers that sort of see MyGov straight away and they hesitate straight away and they don't really read the address and then they hesitate, click the link or call the number, and then I have to go out and sort of fix everything up for them.
And you can, without clicking on the email, just hover over that email address and it should come up.
That's right, yeah. If you're using, say, like a Gmail address or Hotmail address or an Outlook.com or Yahoo email address or web-based email address, you should be okay using that through the web browser to check your emails. If you are using a client like Outlook, Thunderbird, or Apple Mail, just hover over the email. Don't try to click any links in there. Just sort of hover over it. Check the email address. If it looks legitimate, then you can respond to it. If it doesn't look legitimate, just delete it.
And is there any other training we can be providing users of the system beyond phishing scam? What else can we be giving them as tips or things to look out for, Nicholas?
For phishing scams, again, sort of look at the spelling. Always check the grammar and spelling. These phishing scams, they tend to be from other countries that don't speak English too well. And basically, you'll see a lot of grammatical errors and spelling errors and things that just don't really make sense. But so, again, always take your time. Don't go, oh, no, I have to click this now. Always take your time and read the email and go, that doesn't sound right to me.
And especially, don't give any personal information, any bank information.
Never do that. Never do that. Say, for example, if it's a MyGov or anything like that, MyGov have all your details. They never need anything of yours. Basically, if they can say to you, oh, you're Joe Bloggs, you live at this address and everything like that, they have your information. You can just confirm yes or no. But if it's in an email and they're requiring all these details, like bank details and all that, do not respond to it. You can either, if you feel safe enough, you can use the MyGov app. But if you want to feel safer and old school, just go straight into your Centrelink office and then provide those details there.
Absolutely, or give them a call because you're generating the phone call.
Give them a call, yeah.
And that's the same thing as well with phone calls, isn't it? Because this all impacts on that as well.
Oh, my gosh. Like, if I had a nickel for every time I, had to do one of these. Every time I go out and someone's called, I run through the question, have you given the bank details? No. Have you given them access to your computer? Yes. Sometimes it's normally yes or no. The bank details, a lot of people are becoming more cluey, which is good. They're not giving the bank details straight away. They're sort of letting them on the system, thinking that they might be from MyGov, they might be from NBN, they might be from Telstra, any company that can they basically say who they are. And they'll just remote in using a free piece of software like TeamViewer, which is a publicly known remote access software. Anyone can use it. And using TeamViewer brings back to the security aspect with security hardware, because they're using a brand like TeamViewer that's publicly trusted, so that's automatically allowed. So that's what's called a man-in-the-middle attack.
I'm talking to Nicholas Michalakis today from Tweak IT about all things cybersecurity. Can we also talk about Facebook, Instagram, where people click links?
Oh, great one that you brought up. A few of the scams that I've been going out to fix up have been from phone calls or emails. They've been from Facebook ads. Someone's clicked on a link on a Facebook ad and a pop-up comes on their Windows computer which says your Windows has been attacked, it's been locked down and everything like that. Basically, that's a browser hijack, which is basically, think of a browser window that's full screen. There's no click minimize or anything like that. It takes over the whole screen. It's mocked up to make it look like your computer has been frozen or locked up. And basically from there, I go in, reset the browser, clear all that out, and then clean the system from there. But the thing is, it's coming through Facebook now. They're paying ads to Facebook, and Facebook are not vetting their ads.
So really, people should, if they want something, then look at what the company is, go and look up the website themselves, search it, and
that's
then go
right.
through that way.
So basically, before you go, check what the website is, copy and paste into Google. Don't go to the website, copy and paste it into Google, and basically, with the follow-up words, is this safe? And paste the domain name in there, and then basically Google it, and you probably might find mainly Reddit. Reddit is basically like a worldwide forum, and you'll probably find a forum chat on there basically saying, no, don't go here, this is a scam.
Yes, news travels fast.
If you're running antivirus on your system, you do sometimes, depending on your package, you do have a browser extension which basically searches all your Google search, and then basically gives you a green tick if it's safe or red X if it's unsafe. So that's another thing I give my clients as well. So because they'll Google something, they might not go to the right address. But at least if they have that sort of visual indicator, that sort of gives them a clear indication whether to go there or not.
Good advice. Nicholas, one of the other things I want to talk about, well, a few actually, is embedding cybersecurity into your existing risk management practices. So, for example, backups, people still or using multi-factor authentication.
Multi-factor authentication is vital now. We're beyond the early 2000s where you could just get away with a password. And sometimes I was even guilty of it too, using the same password for everything for multiple websites. And then I started noticing in my browser, because I use Google Chrome as a browser, I use their password manager, which is free to use. Anyone can use it. The same with Apple. You can use Safari with Apple Keychain. What it will do is it will scour the internet for your email address and passwords that you've used, and it will search the web and go, look, we've found this many websites that actually have your password saved. We recommend changing your password. And what a password manager will do is randomly generate a 12 to 32 character password, including letters, numbers, lowercase, uppercase, and character. And then they'll basically generate a unique one for each website that you go to. And I know that sort of gets a bit annoying where it's, I've got to write down my passwords and everything like that. That's why a lot of people tend to use the same password or make variations of it.
Well, it's far more annoying to be scammed, isn't it, and to lose all of your money?
It's basically once bitten, twice shy. Once it happens, a lot of customers will start taking these new practices on, which I'll sort of implement. Use a password manager. Secondly, write your passwords down on a physical, in a little black book or on a piece of paper, or print them out, because you never know when the power might go out and you don't have your password, or you don't have access to your computer and you need your password.
And of course, we rely on online everything, don't we, now? And that is the problem.
It's such a necessity now. It's like water and electricity now. We can't live without it.
Absolutely. Now, I did mention backups to you. A lot of organisations have forgotten or not really, or they do backup. And I'll say to them, have you ever tried to revive the backup? Oh, no. We're just backing up.
Backing up. A lot of people will tend to have one backup, if they do. I've had experiences where a customer will be like, your computer's died. Oh, have you got a backup? And they've just looked at me blankly like, no. And so once I fixed the system, I applied the rule of three. Always have three backups. One on-site, one off-site, and a secondary on-site backup. So that could be two external hard drives and one off-site backup. Some businesses will buy what's called a NAS, a network attached storage. So think of an external hard drive that's connected to the network, and you can access it over the internet. So it's like your own personal cloud that you basically pay in full. Or you can pay for a subscription for a online cloud service like Dropbox, OneDrive, iCloud, and I think Box as well.
I always think with things like this, Nicholas, it's a little bit like house cleaning. You know you have to do it. If you don't do it, it just gets worse and worse. That's that same thing with filing, backup, changing your passwords.
That's why Windows has sort of kind of made it a bit easier. So if you're basically subscribed to the Office 365 package, a lot of people sort of about, well, why should I pay for Office and everything like that and get the Office package? The way I sell it to customers, I say, look, think of it like this. You get 1 terabyte included with your package. So think of you're paying for the backup storage and you're getting Office for free. Once they've gotten past that, when you set up OneDrive, it's basically a set and forget system, because it will automatically back up your desktop, documents, pictures, video, and music folder.
That's excellent. Can we talk about this access to the system and about, as I said, because volunteers do come in and so do people come in to use the system? Because part of the issue is if they bring in their own system that's not protected, isn't it?
Yes. So again, that would come down to the network again. So if the network is structured so it has rules and policies and restrictions in place, any guest computer that connects to the network should be safe and not infecting any other systems. But if those aren't in place, it's basically someone comes into the office with a cold, sneezes, coughs, everyone's going to get sick.
And we should be looking at constant culture of cyber resilience and doing some mandatory training, which is part of like today's podcast, but really it should be something a bit like the fire drill. Right, let's send out something and see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's actually a really good question. So basically what you should have is sort of like a mock-up scenario where someone brings in a virus computer and just not actually anything threatening, but sort of see what the scenario would be if you did this and show how it would impact the rest of the system.
And Nicholas, there is a website you can go to see what current scams are on, isn't there?
Yeah, so basically if you just Google current scams, what I tend to be using now more than Google, because I'm finding Google's a bit lacking with search, is ChatGPT.
Good old ChatGPT, it's become everyone's
new
friend.
It's basically the new Google, because what it does now with the new 4.0 model is it'll actually search the web for your answers. So basically, rather than trying to Google things anymore, and all you're getting is basically paid ads at the top, you're actually getting the information that you want.
That's very true. And also now, I think we need to think of cybersecurity like there used to be business continuity plans. There needs to be a plan for what happens if there's a cybersecurity incident. If someone does go on social media at work, click on the wrong link, then they've let someone in.
That's right. That's why a lot of businesses are now blocking social media. So if you want to access your social media at work, you have to jump off the Wi-Fi, maybe use your phone's hotspot to do that. So I think they probably only limit them to employee phones, which are not connected to the Wi-Fi at all. They're just using their own personal data connection.
So really keeping everything off of the computers at work, you've got to do it on your own phone.
And again, why are you using social media when you should be working? Oh,
that is true, although I do believe there's a lot of online shopping done. Can we also just talk about some stories? I heard one the other day that I was very concerned about where there was a Teams meeting, and in that meeting, one of the team members said, oh, look, you know, we need some money transferred to our department to purchase X. Can I have approval for that? The person was given approval by a manager, and it turned out that the person on the Teams meeting was a fake, was an avatar, and it was so real that no one else picked it. So the money was transferred to, obviously,
Wow, that would lead to believe that that's either a part of a phishing scheme, so their email system may not be completely secure, which means someone may have clicked a link in the past or during that time, and basically it's leaked contacts out, and they've gotten access and seen a Teams meeting, and they've sort of jumped in there. I think the Teams meeting that you sent to me earlier, I could jump in as a guest. So they can jump in as a guest, create their own name, and voila, they're in. So it is a very scary time that we're living in. It's just
that we literally impersonating. Someone's being impersonated.
Oh my
physically.
God, it's I don't know, it's like con artists of the 21st century.
It's a scary time. Like the pickpockets that it used to be.
The pickpockets, because a lot of people when they call up, I've been hacked, I get a little irate at that, and I say, no, you've not been hacked. You've been conned. The guy on the other end knows nothing about hacking. If a hacker was trying to get you, they wouldn't go for you. They'd be going for big, big companies or big, big government bodies to do some damage, where the rest of us are sort of like, we're fine. But it's these con artists that read a script. They pay for this software on the dark web that can encrypt your data. They just use free software to access your computer. They say the right words to you and sort of put the fear of God in you. And then if you sort of listen to that and go through it and follow through the steps where they will get into your system and go, oh no, this is not good. Sometimes they'll install keyloggers and get you to try and log into a bank. And then they'll put up a fake website. For example, like with ANZ Bank, they have a very good mock-up of the ANZ website, as many other banking websites. You log into your banking details. It doesn't log in. And you go, oh no, your banking, you might have put in the wrong password. You've put in the correct password. They now have that password.
So this goes back again
where a lot of banks now are doing 2FA, not just SMS, but also having what's called rolling codes where you add that to an authenticator like Google Authenticator or Microsoft Authenticator. And that adds a proper level of security on your device because like an SMS in America, because you don't need an ID to register a phone number, you can actually call a phone company and go, oh, I'm such and such. I've lost my SIM card. Can you send me out a new one? Yeah, sure, done. So you can get a person's number, get them to send the 2FA codes to that number, and then you're straight in. Or at least in Australia, you do need identification for that. We are getting to a point where who knows what's going to happen next. So using multi-factor authenticators, so SMS and a 2FA app, like Microsoft Authenticator and Google Authenticator, do prevent that from happening. And also a very strong password.
Yes, your passwords. Now, I did hear that using a sentence personal only to you can be useful because it's very hard for people to create that.
That's right.
Good tip. Now, can I also ask you about the whole concept of having passwords and having information is to ID somebody? You've just been talking about ID. The problem is, my objection is giving it to a gym, that it doesn't matter where I live because I come to you, but they want your address, they want your phone number. You have to put in, you know, your password. Please don't, of course, use the same one as all the others. But do you see this as something that's going to change where by giving people all this information about ourselves, we're everywhere on the web for anybody to piece together?
Oh, we are. I mean, hotels, restaurants and gyms and all that, they all just do it for telemetry because they just want to know where their customers are coming from. I understand that. But at the same time, a lot of those details, like address and everything like that, if you don't feel comfortable with it, they're never going to know. You can always just put a variant of your address in.
Mm.
Like sometimes when I sign up for a food delivering app, I don't put my full name in. I put like my internet handle on there and they're okay with that. You can just make up a nickname. But again, where is this information going? How secure is the information where it's being stored? That's a very good question.
And would you also advise, Nicholas, to perhaps have an email address that you use for signing up to restaurants, for all that sort of stuff, a bit like having a debit card that you use, not a credit card?
Yeah, to have a burner email address is always a good thing. So if you're with Apple, it's actually a lot more convenient because you can create a iCloud email address and you can create multiple variations of it as well. And Apple also basically hide your IP address with that as well, with an iCloud email address. If you don't have an iPhone, you can just create a free Gmail, Hotmail address, whatever you want, because it's free, you can just use it. And what I tend to do is I tend to go into the settings, and what it will do is as soon as an email comes to that burner email address, I have that automatically forward to my main daily email address, so I get a copy of it straight away.
That's,
I don't have to keep checking two email addresses.
That's great.
That's just me being lazy, but yeah.
No, I understand that. Nicholas, there's a raft of information here. You've shared so much, but really, obviously, if you're going to do something that's really going to be a value...
Oh, for hours.
You would need to come and have a look. How do people find your organisation?
Currently, Google and word of mouth.
So they look for Tweak?
Tweak IT. If you type in Tweak IT near me, mostly in the hills, they tend to find me pretty quickly. The CBD, if you type in Tweak IT computers or Tweak IT repairs, you'll tend to find me straight away. You'll see a graffiti cat logo. That'll be me.
So that's Tweak, T-W-E-A-K. So it's actually called Tweak It. Nicholas, thank you so much for your sharing today. Great tips in there.
You're
I
welcome.
Certainly learnt something and hope that others did as well. Thank you for joining Community Conversations today.
Thank you for having me, Kerry.
On behalf of all the Community Centres SA teams, thanks for listening. Feel free to get in touch with us at communitycentressa.asn.au. We'll be back next week. But wherever you are, at home, with your work and in your daily life, we hope that we have planted a seed to enable ongoing community conversations.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.